Good evening, everybody. I'm so pleased to come here once again and see some old faces and some new faces, and also so many people coming this evening. It is very uplifting feeling to see people showing great interest in Dhamma. Tonight, as you have already heard, I am going to talk on understanding or misunderstanding of Dhamma, Karma. I have given many talks on this topic. Some of you have downloaded and made into MP3. Perhaps you might have listened to that talk already. And yet, karma is such an inexhaustive subject. Therefore, it doesn't matter how much you talk about it, you still want to learn more about it. And still, it is a difficult subject to comprehend fully, well. And Buddha said, karma is a subject that only the Buddha can explain fully well. Others understand it to some extent and end up with a lot of misunderstanding. And therefore, every unenlightened person tend to have certain amount of blind spots as well as karma is concerned. I think these days, when everything goes well, they have good job, their health is good, family is doing well, everybody is happy, get good salary, everybody is friendly, united, become popular, successful, then people say, "Thank God, I am doing well." When anything goes wrong, lose their job, become unhealthy, lose friends, become unpopular, infamous, then they say, "What to do? That is my karma." All bad things they attribute to karma, all good things they attribute to God. That is total misunderstanding of karma. And somebody approached a monk in the time of the Buddha and said, "Is it true that the Gautama Buddha says that words and deeds have no effect? They are insignificant, meaningless. Only the thoughts become meaningful. Is it true?" So this monk did not know how to answer the question. He went to Venerable Ananda and asked Ananda, "Is it true that deeds and words have no effect? Only the thoughts have some effect." There is an element of truth in that also, but this particular person had not grasped the full meaning of these three, thoughts, words and deeds. In some places, as you have already heard, karma is chetana. You have heard over and over again, karma is chetana. The thought is karma. What about the words and deeds? Are they not karma? This was a big debate in the time of the Buddha. Nigantanatha Buddha openly, publicly said, thoughts and words have no effect whatsoever, but the deeds, physical deeds, are more effective, because physical deeds are gross, visible, tangible, and make somebody painful by giving a physical blow and beating up and so forth. people can feel the feeling. When you do physically, you know, touching, massaging, and so forth, you feel the physical pleasure or physical pain. And therefore, they said, what is most important is not words or thoughts, something that you can really physically experience, that is more important. When it was brought to the Buddha's attention, Buddha refuted it. Buddha said, it is not the physical or verbal things, deeds and words that are more effective, but what happens in the mind. So one of the debaters challenged the Buddha. Then Buddha said, well, if you are Nigantas, he was a Nigantas follower, he went to the Buddha and challenged the Buddha. And he said, words and thoughts are so insignificant, not even visible, it cannot hurt somebody that strongly, severely, as physical deeds. Then Buddha said, well, in that case I ask you some question, but you must stand your ground and don't deviate. You must promise you maintain your position. He agreed. Then Buddha said, suppose you are Nigantha, observe certain principles. One of them is that they don't drink cold water, because if they drink cold water, they would kill living beings, because they believe that they have various tiny, minute, invisible living beings in water. Therefore, if they drank cold water, they would kill these invisible living tiny beings. However, this Nigantha suddenly falls sick and he needs water. He cannot find hot water. All he finds is cold water. But according to his principle, he is not supposed to drink cold water, and he has a great desire to drink cold water. The great urge, needs to drink cold water. Because of his principle of not drinking cold water, he doesn't drink. But the desire to drink cold water is still there. And with this desire, he dies. Then the Buddha asked this man, what is the cause of his death? Cause of his death is not having cold water, but he had the desire to drink cold water. He, with this desire, he passed away. Then Buddha asked, has he done anything physical? No. All he had was the desire to drink cold water. And the desire not being fulfilled, he passed away. So Buddha asked, then, which is greater, the physical action or thought? This man had to agree with the Buddha that it was his thought that made him kill. So Buddha proved that thoughts have greater effect. And moreover, words and deeds are expressed because of thoughts. Among right thoughts, Buddha used in Noble Eightfold Path, you know, thought of renunciation, thought of loving friendliness, thought of compassion are very powerful, wholesome karmas. And in Chula Vedala Sutta, Venerable Bhikkhuni Dhammadinna, answering her former husband's Visakha, answering his questions, she said thoughts are called vitakka vichara, are called verb conditioner. Verb conditioner. Vitakka vichara, initial thought and sustained thought are word conditioner. Because having thought, we are expressed. So, in all these places in Buddha's teaching, we find thoughts are more important than words and deeds. Now I am talking, these words escaped my lips according to my way of thinking. If I cannot think, I cannot express these words. And these words convey a message, and you get the message. If I don't have thoughts, you cannot get this message. I can make a lot of sound, and these sounds may not make any sense if I don't think. So if I think correctly, properly, clearly, I can express correctly, properly, clearly. So it is the thought that makes things more sensible, meaningful. And it is because of our thoughts we do, we speak and we act according to our thinking. So Buddha said, when this question came up, all our karma depends on contact. All our deeds depend on contact. If somebody says that deeds are done by somebody, or deeds are done by nobody, or deeds are done by both somebody and oneself, and still these deeds are done through contact. And the contact depends on our thinking. We mentally make the contact, and according to this contact we feel, according to feeling we commit a deed. If the feeling happen to be unpleasant, we express unpleasant words. If the feeling happen to be pleasant, we express pleasant words. So even the expression of pleasantness and unpleasantness depending on our feeling. And the feeling will not arise without our thinking. And therefore, contact, feeling come out of our thinking. So in every respect, the karma is based on our thinking. We read in Dhammapada, the very first stanza of Dhammapada, everybody knows perhaps by heart, Mano Pubbangama Dhamma and so forth. All our actions are led by the mind. Mind is the master, mind is the creator, mind is the teacher, mind is the head and leader and so forth. And depending on the way we think, we express. And therefore, karma should be defined according to the way we think, not according to the way we act. Every action emanates, manifests from our way of thinking. And that is why the Buddha emphasized the thinking makes the karma a karma. Now, sometimes people say karma is a law of action and reaction. That doesn't sound correct, because action and reaction is just physical law. In physics we learn every action has a reaction. The fact that every action has a reaction does not mean that it is a karma. So therefore there has to be another component to karma, not just mere action and reaction. Other component that contribute to make action and reaction a karma is volitional activity, the will, the thinking, thought. Therefore, when we define the karma, we have to say any thoughts, words, deeds committed intentionally by a person whose mind is not free from greed, hatred and delusion is karma. I think that's a very comprehensive, concise, precise, clear definition of the word karma. That means, let me repeat this definition for everybody to remember. Any thought, word or deed committed intentionally by a person whose mind is not free from greed, hatred and delusion is karma. This means, if the thoughts, words, deeds committed without intention, that's not a karma. If the thoughts, words, deeds committed without greed, hatred and delusion, that also is not a karma. For example, an arahant, a Buddha, Paccheka Buddha, also express thoughts. They commit deeds, they express words, and their thoughts, words, deeds are not considered to be karma because their minds are not influenced, affected by greed, hatred and delusion. The mind is totally free from greed, hatred and delusion, and therefore whatever they say, whatever they do, whatever they think end up as just mere action. This is called kriya. Kriya limits only to the action. It is very much like physical law of action and reaction. They have the body, they have the mind, they express words, but behind these words, the expressions, there is no greed, hatred and delusion. So, anybody who expresses thoughts, words, deeds must have greed, hatred and delusion in the mind to make an action, thoughts, words, deeds, a karma. And therefore, karma can be divided into two categories, wholesome karma and unwholesome karma. Something becomes wholesome or unwholesome depending on the intention. If the intention turns out to be unwholesome, it is unwholesome karma. If the intention happens to be wholesome, that's a wholesome karma. This is how we define the wholesomeness and unwholesomeness of karma. So, whenever we talk about karma, we have to bring both wholesomeness and unwholesomeness into our talking, into our definition. Karma is so complicated, so difficult to understand. Buddha gave very beautiful, very comprehensive four examples. Suppose there is a person who kills, steals, commit sensual misconduct. I use the word sensual misconduct rather than sexual misconduct. I want to explain why I use the word sensual misconduct instead of sexual misconduct. Some of you know Pali. According to Pali, the word given in the five precepts is kamesu micchachara. Kamesu is a plural word. If it is single, it should be kame or kamamhi. Since it is plural, it is used in plural sense, kamesu. Kamesu means sensual pleasures. So, misconduct in sensual pleasures. What are the sensual pleasures? The word sensual pleasures always is used in plural. Kamanang adinava, even their kamanang is a plural of possessive case, plural, not kamasa. Kamasa singular, kamanang is plural. Pancha kama guna, pancha means five, kama means pleasure, guna means virtues or the benefits. And so forth, the word kama always is used in plural. So, kamesu micchachara therefore means abusing sensual or pleasure or misconducting sensual pleasures. What are the misconduct of sensual pleasures? We abuse our senses. That's the misconduct. We abuse our eyes. we abuse our ears, we abuse our nose, we abuse our tongue, we abuse our body. Abusing body is kama, sexual misconduct. Abusing our eyes is sensual misconduct. Abusing our ear is sensual misconduct. Abusing our nose, sensual misconduct. Abusing our tongue is sensual misconduct. How we abuse our eyes? We keep looking and looking and looking and watching and watching and watching TV. We abuse our eyes. We watch all kind of obsessive movies. This is how we abuse our eyes. We go and see all kind of unnecessary things, abusing our eyes. Read trash, abusing our eyes. Instead of reading meaningful things, useful things, reading Dhamma, reading something sensible, reading something educational, reading something that can bring us some benefit, we read trash, abusing our eyes. Abusing our ears, listening to similarly listening to various trash, various abusive language, gossip, slanderous talk, harsh words, insulting words, filthy words, we listen. And we enjoy that. Many people enjoy listening to trash. That is how we abuse our ears. We abuse our nose. These days abusing nose is very common among some young children. Some children go to a hardware store and open paint thinners and sniff to get high. And thereby sometimes they kill their nerves, their neurons in the brain. And some children sniff the magic markers. And then they get high. And sometimes children even die. They can sniff all kind of wrong things to get high. And this is how they abuse their nose. Abusing our tongue is very, very common. We abuse our tongue in two ways. By putting wrong things in and bringing bad things out. We eat wrong things. We eat very unhealthy food. Abusing our tongue. Abusing our taste, we become obese. 60% of Americans are obese. The treatment for the obesity in America is making chairs bigger, making ambulance beds bigger, making their sleeping beds bigger, buying two airplane seats, and making coffins bigger. Making hospital beds bigger. That is how they treat abusing their body. Instead of slimming down, they keep making the body wide body. So this is how they abuse the tongue. Using trashy, unhealthy, junk food. This is not a secret. You read National Geographic. They give these statistics that 60% of Americans, I live in the United States for almost 40 years. I have seen when I come to these countries, I don't see that many obese people. Go to Europe, not that many obese people. But go to America, you can see every nook and corner you can find obese people. No discipline. They learn how to abuse their tongue. And the other way of abusing tongue is using harsh words. And Buddha said, mukha satyena vitudeti. That means we use a verbal dagger to attack people. People use certain insulting words, abusive language, that can cut through your marrow. Sometimes they use such an innuendo language, insulting language, abusive language, harsh words to hurt others. And Buddha said, purusasya hi jatasya kuthari jayate mukhe yena chintati attanam Balo Dumhedino Jana, a person born with an axe in the mouth. Foolish person abuses this axe in the mouth by destroying himself as well as others. Our axe in the mouth is our tongue. Tongue does not wag by itself. There has to be an intention. So intentionally we use our tongue to abuse ourselves as well as others. When we use abusive language, we get hurt ourselves. Eventually we regret and we make many enemies. So these are all called misconduct in sensual pleasures. And this misconduct in sensual pleasures is caused by unwholesome thinking. And that is why this misconduct in sensual pleasures becomes unwholesome karma. Similarly, we can use our intention to use these senses correctly, properly, to commit wholesome karmas, not abusing our senses. Then, so four people, one is killing, stealing, abusing senses, and telling lies, and so forth, committing breaking every rule in the book. And this person, after death, will be reborn in heaven. Another person who abstained from killing, stealing, abusing sensual pleasures, and so forth, observing all moral rules and regulations, living ethical moral life, after death is reborn in a woeful state of existence, even in hell. Third person observes all the moral principles, doesn't abuse his senses, and after death will be born in heaven. Fourth person, having abused senses, broken all the rules, is reborn in woeful state of existence. Now remember these four people. First, having broken all the rules, were born in heaven. Second person, without breaking any rule, born in woeful state of existence. Third person, having observed all the moral principles, were born in heaven. Fourth person, having broken all the rules, is reborn in woeful state of existence. Now, somebody practice meditation, attain jhanas, gain supernatural powers, including divine eye. With this divine eye, he sees the first one, the one who broke all the rules and reborn in heaven. Then this person can conclude, well, there's no good and evil. You do anything you want, after death you will be reborn in heaven. I saw that with my supernatural eyes, and what I say therefore is true. Whatever else anybody else says is wrong. So another person, having attained the same level of supernatural powers after attaining jhanas with divine eye, he will see the second person observing all the rules and regulations and living ethical moral life, after death reborn in woeful state of existence. He would conclude, it doesn't matter how good life you live, after death you will be reborn in woeful state of existence. I saw it with my own eyes, and whoever says something else, anything different from this, is wrong. I saw this with my own eyes, therefore what I say is true. The third person also, having attained supernatural powers through the practice of meditation and with supernatural eyes, will see somebody observing all the moral rules after death, taking rebirth in heaven. Then he says, well, if you observe moral rules, live ethical life, definitely you will be reborn in heaven. That is true, because I saw it. If somebody says anything different, that is wrong. And the fourth person, also having attained that level with supernatural eyes and so forth, sees somebody breaking all the rules, committing offenses after death, is reborn in woeful state of existence, even in hell. So he can conclude, don't break rules, because after death you will be reborn in woeful state of existence. This is true. I saw this with my own eyes. And therefore, whatever else somebody says is wrong. Now, when these four positions were presented to the Buddha, Buddha says, first one who saw somebody committing unwholesome deeds, taking rebirth in heaven, if he says, this is true, I saw this, Buddha said, I grant him that. It is possible. Somebody can commit unwholesome things and still can be reborn in heaven. That's possible. But if somebody says what he saw is true, anything else somebody else says is wrong, I don't grant him that. Why is that? Because this person, although he committed unwholesome things now, and he has done something wholesome some other time, either in his life or at the moment of death. Remember some individuals like Mata Kundali. Remember Mata Kundali's story. He has done nothing wholesome. But at the moment of death, Buddha appeared before him, seeing the Buddha's figure. This person was very pleased, and after death he was reborn in heaven. See, Angulimala committed so many murders, and finally he became an arahant. Devadatta attained even jhanas, had supernatural powers. After death he was reborn in a woeful state of existence. So Buddha said, somebody can commit unwholesome deeds and still it is possible for the person to be reborn in heaven, because while committing unwholesome things periodically, occasionally, sometimes, even at the moment of death, the person might have committed something wholesome. And all other three cases also like that. Somebody who has committed unwholesome things, wholesome things, and taken rebirth in a unwholesome place, painful place, because while committing wholesome things, sometimes at the moment of death, he might have committed something unwholesome, and according to that, he is born in an unhappy state. Somebody committed wholesome things, continue to do wholesome things, even at the moment of death, his mind was clean and pure, then he was born in heaven. Somebody committed unwholesome things and continue to do unwholesome things. At the moment of death, he has unwholesome state of mind. According to that state of mind, he is born in unwholesome place. And therefore, in all these cases, what really counted is the state of mind. State of mind. That is why the Buddha said, Chetanaham bhikkave kammang vadami. It is that, not what we see of outside, superficially. Superficially we may see somebody doing something, either wholesome or unwholesome, but that is not what really counts, but what happens inside the mind. According to that, the birth in wrong place or right place takes place. So, karma therefore is very complicated. There are many, many situations, many examples to quote. Suppose somebody Buddha gave very beautiful examples. Somebody is very, very rich. And this person is very influential person in the society. He knows every politician, every lawyer. He knows every businessman. He knows all powerful people. And he commits some crimes. Nobody pays attention to him because he is so powerful person, influential person. He may commit a very, very powerful, heinous crime, even murder. Nobody pays attention to him. So Buddha gave a simile to illustrate his situation. Suppose you take a teaspoonful of salt and put it into a river Ganges. Can you make the river Ganges salty by putting teaspoonful of salt in it? No. Why, the river Ganges has so much water. Teaspoonful of salt is nothing. Similarly, this man who is influential, powerful, rich, he knows everybody, must have been enjoying his wholesome karma that he has committed in his previous life. Therefore, even if he committed unwholesome karma in this life, will not affect him right away. It doesn't mean that he will not bear the fruit of this unwholesome karma in future, but in this life, he enjoys. On the other hand, there's a very, very poor man. Nobody knows him, not educated. And he may steal one small grape from a supermarket. He would be caught for shoplifting and sued, put him in the jail. Why? Because he was poor, not having very powerful karma, he just happened to be human being and having very little wholesome karma, and therefore crime he committed was punished severely. It is just like putting full of salt into a small teacup, and the cup of water becomes salty. Similarly, the karma, various things are there to affect the karma. They are called upadhi sampatti, kala sampatti, upadhi vipatti, kala vipatti, and so forth. Many, many, many factors. And karma does not function alone. It has four other laws. And these four laws affect us every given moment. Every moment. They are called five laws. These five laws, they don't take turns to operate. They operate all the time, every time, anywhere in every person's life. What are the five? They are called physical inorganic order, called utunyama. Utunyama means seasonal changes. When season change, it affects everybody. Rich, poor, young, old, educated, uneducated, doesn't matter. Everybody is affected by the weather. Whether it is cold or hot or humid or non-humid and dry or wet, whatever. Second law is called physical organic order. That is biological order. Our biology, our genes, is functioning all the time. They also don't take turns. They are functioning in our personality all the time. The third is the law of chitta, mental state. Mental state function exactly in certain order. They don't differ from person to person. For example, when the eyes, visual objects come in contact, eye consciousness arises, nobody can stop it. Eye consciousness arises when the eyes, visual objects come together. As long as we are not dead, we are alive, we are awake, eye consciousness arises that instant. As soon as these three, eyes, visual objects, eye consciousness, when these three come together, contact arises. This is called thinna sangati passo. Contact definitely arises in the same way in every person. This is the way of mind operates. And this happens, they also don't take turns. That today I operate this way and tomorrow you operate another way. Not like that. The fourth law is called Dhamma Niyama. What is Dhamma Niyama? Law of Dhamma. Law of Dhamma operates whether the Buddhas come into existence or not. Law of Dhamma operates. Buddhas don't come and initiate the operation of Dhamma. For example, Buddha said, Uppadava bhikri tathagatanam, anuppadava tathagatanam, titava sa dhatu dhamma titata dhamma niyamata. Sabbe sankhara anicchati, tantathagato abhisambujyati, abhisameti, abhisambujyitto, abhisametto, achikkati, deseti, panyapeti, pattapeti, vivarati, vibhajati, uttani karoti. Because whether the Buddhas come into existence or not, this established Dhamma, this law of Dhamma, this element of Dhamma operates. What is the established Dhamma? This steady Dhamma, element of Dhamma, that all conditioned things are impermanent. Buddhas don't come and make the world impermanent. Whether the Buddhas are born or not, impermanence is impermanent. They are permanently impermanent. Even if you attain enlightenment, impermanent continues to be impermanent. You don't make impermanent permanent after attaining enlightenment. And that which is impermanent is unsatisfactory whether the Buddhas come into existence or not. Nobody can make impermanent things happy. It is impermanent and therefore it is unsatisfactory. That which is impermanent, unsatisfactory is insubstantial. Nobody can change that. That also is established Dhamma. Another established Dhamma, the truth of Dhamma, law of Dhamma is dependent origination. Dependent origination. Things arise depending upon some causes and conditions. When the causes and conditions exist, something happens. Buddhas don't come and introduce this to the world. What the Buddhas do, they realized and explained this. Tantathagato abhisambujyati, Buddhas realize it. Abhisameti, understand it. Abhisambujyitva, abhisamitva, achikkati, they tell the world, panyapeti, establish, vivarati, open, vibhajati, analyze, uttani, karoti, express. That's what the Buddhas do. Then the last law is the law of karma. Karma is achinteya. Buddha visaya, karma visaya is achinteya. That means the field of karma is unthinkable. Buddha visaya is unthinkable. The Buddha's nature, Buddha's power is unthinkable. Dhamma visaya is unthinkable. Chitta visaya is unthinkable. And therefore, friends, talking about karma is not that easy. It is very, very difficult. Only a Buddha, Paccheka Buddha, don't explain, but at least a Buddha and some enlightened arahants And not every arahant can explain Dhamma, but some arahants can explain Dhamma just like the Buddha did. And ordinary people can grope in the dark, not knowing the entire working operation perspective of karma. Therefore, friends, talking about karma is not very easy, but don't give up hope. And don't try to attribute all the wholesome things to God and unwholesome things to karma. And we have to understand karma is both wholesome and unwholesome. Never say that it is because of my karma I suffer. Also we must say, because of my karma I am happy. We must be able to tell, I am so glad that my karma is so good. I can tell that. Because of my good karma, I am a Buddhist monk. Because of my good karma, I have been able to teach Dhamma. Because of my good karma, I meet good people. Because of my good karma, I have made many good friends. Because of my good karma, I have very good parents. Because of my good karma, I live a monk's life. You can say to yourself, because of my karma, I am a good human being. Because of my good karma, I am a Buddhist. You have to be a good Buddha, good, you have to have a committed, wonderful, wholesome karma to be born as a human being. And even better karma, you have to have committed to become a Buddhist. Because the only Buddhist who have completely open mind, open to anything, you can read anything you like, you can say anything you like, go anywhere you like, whether temple or mosque or church, anywhere you want, you can go. Express anything you want. 100% freedom you have. Therefore you should be very, very pleased to say that I have committed a wonderful, wholesome karma to be born as a Buddhist and follow the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. Say, Buddha is my only refuge. Natthi me saranang anyang. Buddho me saranang varang. Etena satchavajjena hotu me jayamangalang. I have no refuge. Buddha is my only refuge. Dhamma is my refuge. Sangha is my only refuge. To say that very bravely, boldly, definitely you have to have come to one wholesome, wonderful karma. With this, friends, I want to conclude tonight's talk, and I didn't think that I would go this long. I thought I would talk only half an hour. But because of your encouragement, your undivided attention, your enthusiasm, your interest in learning Dhamma, I gave this talk this long. Thank you very much.
We would allow 3 questions because of the time constraint. Please.
You are asking how the first time you came to existence? I see, it is just like which came first, eggs or chicken. Now, yeah? No, let me answer that question. I did not answer. I'm not trying to give the full, complete, perfect answer to make him happy. But I have to answer the question. Now, this samsara is, the beginning of samsara is indiscernible. In this indiscernible samsara, nobody can point out, I began at such and such a point and then I began to commit karma. Nobody can say that. It is like a cycle. You know, when you take a cycle, you cannot find, no matter how much mathematics you know, you can find the diameter, radius, circumference, area and so forth of a circle. But you can never find the beginning of a circle. But you can make a beginning of a circle. What you have to do, you draw a circle and draw a line. That line is the beginning and that is the end of the circle. Similarly, we got to start our life with this life. And we don't worry about the past. And we think this life we live because of our wholesome previous karma. And we can never ask when I started committing the karma. We can never ask. Because it is... you remember the Chula Malunke Putra Sutta in Majjhima Nikaya? That the poison arrow. You remember that simile? Like that we are living a very short life. Within that life, what we should do, we must live this life meaningfully, honestly, sincerely, and try to make the best out of this life to liberate ourselves. I would never try to answer the questions beyond this. It's your question.
You see, what the Buddha taught is do good or what evil, do good and purify the mind. That is the teaching of the Buddha. What happened was, the way I understand related to karma, okay, what is the benefit? Those people who do good and those people who do bad, what is the benefit over the do bad? Because both also based on desire, which is a hindrances to purify the mind. So those people who do a lot of bad and people who do a lot of good, what's the benefit? People who do a lot of bad over the one who do a lot of bad on based on purification, I mean based on cultivation. So what is the benefit over that? Some people will say, I do bad, I also can do my cultivation. So can you explain?
Now the question is little complicated. If I try to make it simple, I would put, I reword the question in my own way to answer the question. You are saying that people do bad things because of desire, and also they do good things because of desire.
Yes.
Which of them is better?
The one, people who do good, what is the benefit over the person who do bad for cultivation?
Right. You know, when you do good, we would say it is better than doing bad. Of course, both are doing with desire, because desire is in the mind. I would clarify desire or categorize desire into two groups. One is wholesome desire, other is unwholesome desire. What is unwholesome desire? Desire to perpetuate desire. Desire to increase desire. Desire to continue samsara is unwholesome desire. Wholesome desire is desire to be desireless. Your desire is to reduce desire. And eventually it be free from desire. So I would say that desire is wholesome desire. For example, you desire to attain enlightenment, where you end all this desire. Another desire is desire to be reborn as a human being, divine being in Brahma realms. So you perpetuate your samsaric existence. Somebody who is trying to perpetuate samsaric existence may not care very much for reducing desire. The person simply wants to enjoy samsaric pleasure. So that is what I call unwholesome desire. Okay, one more question, yes. There are two. Okay. Okay, only those two questions. What is yours?
Bhante, I would like to ask a question about karma and fatalism. The victims of the world. There was a previous Buddha who could predict that such a layman would be a Buddha in the future. So my question is, how is it that this Buddha was able to confirm something that will happen eons away, when we know that what we think or do will affect quite in the future, the next life?
Okay. He was able to predict by seeing his, reading his mind, seeing his potential of perfecting himself. The person, a Buddha, is able to tell how this person cleanses the mind, purifies the mind. Although it takes many, many eons, still, with the Buddha's own Buddha knowledge, this is the special knowledge only a Buddha has. With this knowledge, he can tell exactly how long this person would take to perfect his perfections to attain enlightenment. Just like this Buddha, Gautama Buddha, 3 months before his passing away, he predicted exact time and place where he would, when he was going to pass away. Similarly, when this is the special knowledge that the Buddha has, asaya anusaya jnana, asaya anusaya jnana, knowledge of tendencies and influxes of the other person, knowing that he would be able to tell, it takes this long for this person to get rid of this asava, this anusaya, these tendencies, these influxes. That is how, before it happened, a Buddha was able to tell. Only the Buddha, he has a six special knowledges. One is called asaya anusaya jnana. And no other person can do that. So we cannot tell how he did it without knowing this particular knowledge, without having this particular knowledge. Now two more hands are coming up. There was one man, one hand here. Let me, yes.
This is a fun question, in the sense that it has been said that the Maitreya Buddha is right now in Tusita heaven, as been said by the previous Buddha. Now, what happens if a lay person cultivated and goes to get rebirth in Tusita heaven? Will he be able to meet Maitreya Buddha? And how is he going to know that it's Maitreya Buddha? There are a lot of people who are very ambitious to wait for the coming of Maitreya Buddha. But there is a shortcut to meet Maitreya Buddha by getting rebirth in Tusita heaven now.
I believe somebody who commits enough wholesome karma to be born in Tusita heaven and meet Maitreya Buddha Bodhisattva in Tusita heaven. He can tell, because when he goes there, he will see the Bodhisattva is surrounded by other deities and respected him. Wherever Bodhisattva is born, he is the chief. In Tusita heaven now, he is the chief. And everybody else is subordinate to him. It is just like a queen bee, you know, all other bees respect the queen bee. So everybody can know, this is the queen. Similarly, Bodhisattva, even in Tushitava, remember in, according to Jataka stories, when a Bodhisattva was born as an animal, among those animals, he was the chief. If he became a bird, among birds, he was the very powerful bird. Every other bird respected this bird. Similarly, even in Tushita heaven, Bodhisattva, Maitreya Bodhisattva is the chief of all other deities. They are not all Bodhisattvas. Therefore, they all respect it. When you go there, you say, this must be Maitreya Bodhisattva. Now let me see that four other two other questions. Please end up those. Yeah. Actually, eliminating karma is karma takes place by itself. It has to wear out by itself. You cannot eliminate it deliberately. Simply, you cannot wipe it out. It takes its own time, and then it wears out. But when we keep committing many wholesome karmas, and these wholesome karmas become powerful, and the person will bear the fruit of wholesome karma maybe every minute, every hour, every day, every life, and so forth, postponing the results of bad unwholesome karma. Sometimes unwholesome karma will not have a chance to bear fruit. Before they begin to bear fruit, the person would attain enlightenment, and in that life, that person would experience some results of unwholesome karma and dies, and the rest of the karmas becomes ineffective. That's called ahosi karma. So what Buddha recommended is do wholesome karma more and more and more and more to weaken or to not to give a chance for unwholesome karma to bear fruit. I think, what is the next question? Last question, yes. Okay. If bad karma is, if the person knows that the person has done bad karma, then the person must realize that he has done bad karma. The person does not know when its results is going to take place. Person does not know. Only the person knows is that the person has committed bad karma. And therefore, as soon as the person has committed, person realizes that the person has committed unwholesome karma, bad karma, then that moment the person determines not to commit that kind of unwholesome karma again and to keep doing more and more wholesome karmas. That way, again, as I mentioned earlier, the person will not give a chance for unwholesome karma to bear fruit. But you cannot completely stop or prevent or wipe out the results of unwholesome karma. So, Buddha said, yassa papam katam kammam kusalena pitiyati so imang lokam pabhaseti abhamutto chandima. When one knows that one has done unwholesome karma, then immediately start doing wholesome karma. That person will shine like the moon, free from clouds. I think this is enough. I said we will answer two questions. You ask four questions, and I think that may be enough tonight. Thank you very much.